Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is November the 16th of 2016. I'm Nick, here alongside Chris. How you doing, man?
I am Chris. Well, first off, Nick, we just need to kind of get something out of the way at the start of this. I understand it's been a tumultuous week for a lot of people. Things have happened, results happened that people aren't entirely comfortable with, and it's been tough for some people. But I just want you to know, if you are a Steelers fan or a Ravens fan and you're very upset that your teams aren't doing very well and that the currently 0-10 Cleveland Browns still have a chance of winning your division, I just want you to know it'll get better. Yes. It'll get better. You are loved. You are respected. We're here for you. Take care of yourselves. Just want everybody to know that. I figure we just open every week like that now. Like every week we just like comfort people who might be taking things too hard.
Come up with a different topic every week.
Yeah, progressively like lamer. Like, I know that you just recently discovered Q-tips aren't meant to be used in your ears, and you're not sure if you should keep doing it.
What else could they possibly be used for?
cleaning shit. That's what I see on the back of the packages. They put on it like, don't use it, don't put in your ear. I'm like, fuck you. You know full well that's why you get your things used.
What am I going to do? Wrap a goddamn Kleenex around my ear and use it that way?
I am absurdly tired, Nick. I have been having a lot of issues with sleep. I'm pretty sure I have sleep apnea. I'm getting tested for it, but I haven't gotten the results back. But essentially, I slept like 5 hours last night, and I basically felt like I maybe slept 30 minutes overall. Great. I was exhausted in the morning. I was falling asleep at my desk, I was doing everything I can to basically try to keep myself awake, to the point I actually took one of my 15s, and I was like, oh, okay, I'll play a game of Hearthstone to, like, keep my mind active. I fell asleep playing the game of Hearthstone. When I woke up, I had won, which baffles me. I don't know how I won without actively playing the game for probably, like, 2 turns or so. I was like, okay, I'll go grab myself.
You just kind of slumped. You just kind of slumped over, going.
It was Ragnaros. Rag came through for me in the clutch. I'm pretty sure, or my opponent was like sensing how tired I was through the internet. It's like, I'm gonna give this guy.
Oh, I'm gonna give him a pity win.
Yeah, it's happened before. I was so tired. I went to go grab some tea, and I was pouring tea. Like, I was getting the hot water out of the cooler, and I didn't think this actually happened. Like, I just assumed this was something like that just happened in television shows. I literally fell asleep pouring, like, getting my tea, and only woke up once my hand was burned from the hot water overflowing on the cup I was getting out. I am exhausted. And it's not just like, oh, falling asleep kind of tired. I was in that sleep deprivation where, like, logic just breaks your mind. I was reading online. I saw the word, like, someone being called xenophobic. And I was, for probably a solid minute and a half, firmly under the belief that xenophobic meant a prejudice towards the monsters from the Aliens franchise. I was and I sat there for a forever. I was like, why would you say that? Two, why is that? I feel like you should be kind of prejudiced towards them. They're not good people. It's not
they're the villains. Yeah, like, they're vaguely insect-like monsters that kidnap you in order to impregnate you against your will.
I was like, there's no good aliens. There's no good xenomorphs that I know of.
There's the one in the fourth movie that likes Ripley because she's sort of his mother. But even then, he is a horrible monstrous being that needs to be killed.
You could have stopped at fourth movie too at that point. I feel like
that's true.
But the thing that really hit it off, or really like made it such an awkward day, is a girl came in to drop off some supplies at our office. And she started flirting with me. Like, I was helping her get the boxes off the crate and put them somewhere. And she's like, I don't want this to sound weird, but you smell really good. What kind of cologne is that? And in my sleep-deprived state, I couldn't remember what brand or name my cologne was. And I generally am, like, an honest person, so that's the first thing I would have done is try to give an honest answer. But I couldn't remember it. And at that point, you'd be like, okay, well, just say fucking anything. Anybody out there that makes cologne. Be like, Tommy Hilfiger.
Oh, to Chris Evans or something.
Fucking Gap. Just somebody who makes cologne. And in my mind, all I could process in this moment, in this haze, was like, well, Axe makes it. No, don't say Axe. Axe is going to make you sound lame. So I went with the only thing that came to my mind, which was, I'm sorry, I'm way too tired to think of what my cologne's name is, which just immediately put an end to everything. It was her like, oh, yeah, I get that totally. And just the rest of the fucking delivery was just dead silence.
Because it was so...
She's like, I have...
up a conversation after like, that.
Yeah, I have no
idea. I'm too tired to communicate with you on any level. I'm sorry.
She's like, you're too tired to think of what... Like, what kind of answer is that? And as she's leaving, I finally... It's like 5 minutes later, I'm like, Nautica! Without any, like, reestablishment of what the conversation was. So it's just her like, what? I'm like, the clone, it's Nautica. Still not the name. It's still just the brand, but I'm just like, Nautica. She's like, oh, okay. And just leaves in the most awkward moment ever. I'm like, all right, well, tomorrow's going to have to be a better day because this one's starting off a little bit rough.
Oh, my God.
So if you guys start seeing me, like, slowly sink further and further into my chair and to the point where I'm just, like, hunched over, like, snoring, just let it go. It's been a long day, guys. Very tired. Yeah. Let's talk about manga.
Thank God I'm at the point where any time that something like that happens, I just be like, I have a girlfriend, leave me alone. I do not want to interact with you on this level in any capacity. Makes me uncomfortable because I'm socially awkward.
Normally, it's not something that happens a whole lot, but when it did, it's a bummer when it goes that poorly.
All right. Well, Chris is tired, Nick is kind of sick, so let's try and buckle down and get through this. Fortunately, in the short term, we are short two series this week, so we should be able to get through this okay. Unfortunately, yeah, Ashihara has fallen ill again, and so there's not only no World Trigger this week, there's no World Trigger next week either, and in fact, it's going on hiatus for the time being. So... Annalise, I'm sure is going to probably be doing something, for him, as the president of the unofficial Osamu Mikumo fan club. So yeah, bug her, I think, and see if she's going to send a care package to him.
She is. She's been working on one for a while now. And, she's, I think right now just trying to get, as many pieces for it. I think she's planning to send it out next month. So if you want to contribute to it, anything you want to send, it could be a physical item, as long as it's not food, or it could just be something like a message, like a message you've written for him. Anything like that, contact her, Kaito_Ace on Twitter, and send it along, and we'll send those good vibrations over Ashihara's way.
Feel the vibration. Let's move on to the weekly manga recap portion of the manga recap.
Oh, she says you have until December 1st to get the item, so end of the month.
There you go. We're going to start with Black Clover like we usually do. Page 86, Flames of Hatred. This chapter is all about how Fauna, the salamander-wielding mage from Midnight Sun, hates people and Asta in general because he killed Veto, although he didn't kill Veto. Yami did. But for the Black Bull's role in killing Beto, let's just say. Uh-huh. Last time, Asta managed to deflect a fireball back at her. She doesn't seem too put off by that at the start of this one, and she continues using super powerful flame spirit magic, rending a whole bunch of the forest apart with claws of fire, which is pretty badass. Asta is like, I don't care. I have anti-magic swords. Just jumping through it. Attacks her again. Attacks the dragon that she's riding on. And since it's a conjured being, it starts to dissipate a little bit as well. Then all of a sudden, Asta lands on the ground and plants his swords in the ground and crosses his arms. He's like, let's sit down and talk this one out. Badass pose for this. You should go to counseling instead of physically attacking each other.
Let's have a bro-to-bro moment, man. Heart-to-heart.
Let's have a bro-to-bro moment. I'm a girl. Oh.
Can I take your anal virginity? And just like, everyone's like, oh, right, Asta's a monster.
Oh my god. Us is like, why do you hate the Clover Kingdom so much? We're always fighting and we don't even know anything about each other. Why can't we be friends? This is a really weird time to be asked this question, Asta. Wouldn't it have been a good time after the first Diamond Kingdom invasion to be like, why are our kingdoms warring to the Wizard King or something like that? This is a very awkward time to be doing this right after she has started destroying the forest.
I feel like also, haven't we... Kind of, like, haven't they already kind of revealed what their goal is to Asta?
The Midnight Sun, yeah. I think the Vito did. Yeah, you are... We had the whole thing with Leashed, and then we had the whole thing with Vito. Vito didn't explain his backstory, but there is the whole, you know, you have looked down upon those who are blessed with strong mana thing that was established, I think, in conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's like a plot hole or anything like that. I'm just thinking, I was like, doesn't Asta already kind of know why they're angry at one another? I don't know.
I don't know if they've actually established the Warring Kingdoms part of it. I think they might have way back when Mars was first introduced. Fel responds by having her dragon breathe fire at Asta. He is teleported to safety by Finral, gets in and knocks away Fel's attack that she's conjuring in her hand before she can unleash it, and then starts yelling in her face because Asta has no sense of volume control.
She just goes deaf from him screaming in her ear spontaneously.
That's his ultimate attack, just screaming enthusiastically in your ear.
Or, oh man, wouldn't that be like... That would be like a Twilight Zone episode, but like... Asta's attempts to, like, make peace and friends with everybody is constantly ruined because he has no, like, lower level, so he's constantly, like, blowing out people's eardrums and, like, removing the ability to communicate with others in the world.
Asta demands to know, because your friend really hated us too, and he was full of despair, so tell me why. Can't we just understand each other? Ebony. Ivory. It's so lame.
I'm like, Nick, there's no black people in the Black Clover world.
There's no black people in manga, Chris. Let's be serious.
Every so often, look, it's like two and one.
It's like, oh my god, a black person. So Fel has a flashback to, I believe... when she was a little kid. I don't think we actually see Fel in the flashback. Because we see who I'm assuming is... I think that this is supposed to be the Wizard King. It might be, like, a young Wizard King. But it could be literally anyone, I guess.
I have no idea.
Whatever. He's walking with two kids hand in hand. And I'm guessing this is Fel's voice saying, Leashed, that person, is he a human? And he says, yes, he's my friend. There's something odd about him. And the guy says, I'm positive that this will become a world where our peoples can live side by side as friends. We'll be able to understand each other. And then, of course, cut to the same memory that Veto has of them just being attacked by the humans and betrayed. And so it goes, but only that human knew where this place was. Such as something that you only get in things that come from Japan. Like the very obvious, I'm not saying his name because it's a mystery. That man.
Yeah. As I say, that man is the big one you usually get, but
that guy, that wizard.
That human's such a, like, distinctly, like, a fusticating kind of fucking phrase.
So they believe that the location of their village was betrayed by this person that was talking about all this unity and bullshit. So, remembering this, the gem on Fel's forehead cracks open, revealing a third eye! She's Yubel! And Fel says, who would believe someone like you? And starts unleashing, like, crystalline magic at Asta. and everyone's freaking out because she's using different kinds of magic than just fire now, as crystals start emerging over her dragon, which is growing bigger and bigger. She's also unleashing wind magic as well. Fellows declares, "Let the flames of my hatred burn you to ashes." And Ass is like, "Okay, then I'll just have to bring out my special move, which I developed while I had two broken arms.
While I was crippled." So, something that's curious, if she has crystal magic, isn't that the exact same combination of magics that Mars has? Because he was, like, a crystal magic user and then had fire magic given to him by, like, a girl who died. Like, they combined the magic or something like that. So, I do find it curious that, essentially, this guy presumably has the exact same, or rather, she has the exact same magic combination as Mars. I can't think that's just coincidence. I feel like there has to be some connection to that.
There does definitely seem to be a connection between them. Which is curious because she's from the Midnight Sun as opposed to the Diamond Kingdom.
So. Yeah. So, interesting. I honestly, I don't have a whole lot to say about this chapter of Black Clover. It's not that it's, like, good or bad particularly. It's sort of just a chapter that kind of needs to happen. Like, they, you know, they've established that all these Eyes of the Midnight Sun generals are all, you know, powerful but have the same kind of backstory, but since it is essentially the same backstory as Veto, I kind of need something a little bit more to get interested in this particular character.
Tropical is proposing that she's actually the same girl from Mars's flashback.
It's potentially, yeah. They're both named Fauna. Oh, then yeah, that seems to be a definite if that's the case. If they have the exact same name, but yeah, I mean, I guess I kind of have to see like the follow-up chapter. This one itself, it's not bad or anything like that. I just didn't have a whole lot of impression on it. I remember reading through it the first time being like, okay. And then reading through it the second time being like, okay, once more. I think the only thing I find odd is that Asta has a new special move when he's been crippled recently. Fair enough.
Okay.
Let's move on to chapter, Fairy Tale rather, chapter 510. The Heart of Natsu. And I think Yukino's on the cover. I don't know. They all kind of look
She's
like
got a me. Gun for some reason.
Yeah, I guess that's what she does now.
Flintlock pistol.
So we open up with the Natsu's group basically sitting over Natsu and Gray and Luvia, kind of lamenting on the fact that Natsu's magic cancer has come back and isn't something that can be controlled or cured anymore, apparently.
It's beyond the realm of Brandish's magic now.
It's even beyond the range of fairy tale friend whose name I can't remember, but the old lady who heals people. It's beyond her right. power as well. She even says, "I cannot treat such a thing." And Di Maria's like, "He's a demon! A demon! That's the only explanation!" And Lucy fights that, saying like, "No, he's not!" And Di Maria shouts back, "What do you know about him?" It's like, I feel like a lot. But,
Oh, known him for a few years now, so...
Lucy says, "I guess it's true that Natsu's violent and doesn't know how to work in the team." Which I didn't really... I guess because he's wild. He's, what do they say, he doesn't work in a team? I never really got that impression from him, though. "But I couldn't believe he'd have a hidden dark side that's not the sort of person he is at all." To which Evergreen says she's in love. I guess that's her way of, like, teasing her. Because it'd be weird if they were like, that's the clue that she is in love with Natsu. If she was like, he can't possibly have an evil side. I'd be like, wouldn't everyone say that? He's, like, the nicest fucking friendship dude. All of a sudden, Natsu's body starts smoking. Like, literally, smoke starts coming off of his body. And Lucy even notes that he's cold, which would be weird since fire dragon and all. We cut inside of Natsu's heart. Literally.
This is so bullshit.
We're in his figurative heart, where Xerath is there as well, communicating with him. And I guess what some sort of weird dimension where only Dragon Slayers and Natsu can communicate with one another.
I don't know if they're actually communicating or what. because later on, someone shows up and is like, no, see, because this is the inside of your heart. He's like, you're dreaming, Natsu.
Well, it seems to certainly be Xerath, because Xerath is actually actively explaining things that Natsu shouldn't himself
know. Yeah.
So, you know, he's basically explains what Natsu's backstory is. It's kind of strange. You'd have almost expected this to be a bigger chapter, because this is the explanation of Natsu's past.
Yeah.
Kind of simple. Natsu lived in a peaceful village with a mother and father and his brother Xerath.
Who looked a lot like Kana, by the way.
Yeah. And a dragon attacked, presumably Actalogia, but could be someone else. And all of Xerath's family, including Natsu, were killed. However, Xerath part-times as fucking Edward Ulrich from FMA and basically conjured his brother back to life using science as the final demon end. So, Natsu isn't I guess it is still the Natsu that was there originally. Didn't create him from scratch, but it's not exactly explained if he healed him or created a new Natsu. Either way, Natsu was basically, like, stored in a tank and revived by Xerath's dark magic, and that's how he got to this point. But there's more beyond that, because, you know, we kind of already had an idea. Not all the specifics. We didn't know that, you know, they had a happy family and shit like that. This is a little bit new. But then it goes on to explain that apparently Dragon Soul made everyone forget of the Dragon Slayers, that they were all friends as kids. Like, Gajio and Natsu were rivals. Wendy was the crybaby who always wanted them to stop fighting. And Sting and Rogue just hung around and did shit, like, and always were jealous of them. And I'm like, that's kind of fucking out of nowhere.
This is really bullshit. It was... Okay, so this now confirms that all the Dragon Slayers, bar Laxus, were...
And Cobra. Just,
well, I mean, yeah, it is really good. Were just... from the ancient past and somehow then survived to this point in the future. Wendy's had, like, more backstory changes than Chad has at this point. It's really stupid. So, a side detail that really annoyed me when I read this was, oh, it's okay, Wendy's really actually hundreds of years old, so she's just like Mavis, where she looks underage, but you can still fap to her, because she's legally over 18.
So here's the thing. This is actually something that we've kind of had hinted at for a long time, because there was that weird rule that Siegfried put during the Fighting Festival arc. He's like, nobody who's not made of stone or over 80 years old can leave this. And for some reason, Natsu and Gajio couldn't leave the barrier.
But then we had the explanation a couple years ago of their dragons were living inside of them.
So
I was like, okay, that's fine. That explains it. And then I was just like, no, they actually were hundreds of years old. And I'm just trying to figure out, I hate this cliche where you have a group of characters that have met under a series of different circumstances in the main timeline. And then you find out, oh no, you actually knew each other all in the past and you were destined to meet again like this. Whether it is, you know, you just lost your memories, like in this case, or in a past life, you know, your ancestors all knew each other, and so this meeting was destined to take place again. It's an annoying cliche whenever it comes up. But this is just like, oh yeah, all these people they knew about, like, oh yeah, Sting and Rogue, they were there too. I was just like, I thought Sting and Rogue were new Dragon Slayers. I thought that...
Well, that's the thing that's really weird. Like... Okay, I get it. Gajio and Natsu were rivals back then, because they're quasi-rivals. They don't really fight anymore, because that stopped being their relationship with one another. And the Wendy
because
thing.
Natsu already had Gray, and Gajio now has Levy, so that doesn't have to be his only character traits.
Yeah. So the weird thing here is when they're like, Sting and Rogue looked up to you guys. And I'm like, yes, that mirrors what their relationship is now. But that was only their relationship because Natsu and Gajio got stuck in time and transported 7 years into the future. So why do they have that same big brother relationship with them in the past when they were presumably actually all the same age? Yet it just conveniently worked out that the two they looked up to got stuck in time 7 years to more naturally create a new fucking, you know, big brother relationship. It's very strange.
I should clarify, that is the thing that annoys me, is when you have these things that appear to happen organically, and then you're like, oh no, they were meant to be that way from a long time ago. These two knew each other in the past, and they had a contentious relationship then, too, and they're just like they do now. It's like, come on.
Yeah, it's writing backwards, where it's like, clearly this was, you know, developed or expanded upon far after the original facts were stated, so you just... You write it in this way to feel like there's more depth and meaning to it, but by doing so, you kind of break a lot of the logic of the series and everything like that. So it's just sort of strange. But we can't sit on that for too long, because this is where it gets really weird. And I guess Sting is actually inside Natsu's fucking heart or something. It's not entirely clear,
He replaces Xerath at this point, which is why I'm saying, like, so wait, did Xerath stop communicating with him, and then the rest of Natsu's heart just kind of kept on filling in the gaps? What the hell?
It's just this moment where you're like, it can't just be Natsu's subconscious again, unless he's just subconsciously forgetting and deciding now to remember a whole lot of things, because...
Yeah, there's a joke where Natsu is like, what the hell happened to Xerath? And Sting says, well, this is the inside of your heart, and your consciousness has erased his presence, and that's what happened. Natsu's just like, I don't get it. And it's like, oh, it's Natsu stupid. And it's like, no, that just makes sense. I'm with him.
Yeah, because like Sting comes in, and he's like, our dragons would all get together a few times a year, and they brought them with us, you know, brought us with them. So I guess that's the thing, that they were always being raised by their dragons, and like came and hung out and stuff, but... Essentially, this then cuts away to Sting. Like, the only reason that Sting is the one actually explaining this to him is because it's meant to link into the fact that Sting is, like, the hero character of this chapter. Otherwise, it would make more sense for almost anybody else of the Dragon Slayers to explain this to him.
Laxus shows up. Yeah, but I'm a Dragon Slayer! That's because I'm not weird like you five.
It honestly would, because he actually has more of a relationship with Natsu. I mean, these are guys who, like, Natsu is friends with, but they don't... Like, they're not guildmates or anything like that. Everyone else would make more sense. Regardless, Sting is writing about... I guess he was apparently saved by Siegfried, and he needs to rescue everybody. And he starts smelling magic and follows it. We get a weird shot of Yukino, I guess, orgasmed to death, just about. And...
Where did that slime come from that's making her dress so transparent? That's creepy.
I don't know. I think it's Lecter. Yeah, Lecter's the cat, and he screams out, help us. Which, of course, is the sign for Sting to literally whoosh in and save the day.
Sting's descending from the rafters!
Kicks him right in the face. This one's not nearly as cool.
He's here to take on the NWO!
Not nearly as cool as the WCW Sting. Everyone's so grateful, and Sting's like, you really did a number on the people in my guild. I do like how Licardi totally no-sells it, of like, oh yes, under the fool has arrived. And fires an attack, but Sting eats it. He devours the attack. And he's like, don't you know, I'm a white dragon slayer. So he's technically a light dragon slayer, but I guess they're just saying like this. Well, we know it's light magic. And it's just the weird, like, I'm a white dragon slayer. I guess that's, I don't know. I feel like you could have just said light dragon slayer. I don't understood it. But, the chapter finishes with Sting saying, you know, there's something I don't like about you. You smell just like Natsu-san. And that's the entire chapter. I don't mind, like, Sting coming in here does make sense. He's a character I would not be surprised to get a big role in things. He is one of the five real Dragon Slayers and one of the only seven, really, that are in the series. So it makes sense that he does have a role within things. And this does make sense because we know he's a light Dragon Slayer. So the fact that he's going up against somebody who uses some form of light magic, again, it makes sense. You know, it helps understand why this guy can beat somebody who's considered on the same power level as August and Irene. That part doesn't bother me. It's the flashback stuff felt very anticlimactic for what's essentially supposed to be Natsu's backstory. And
it also
the
feels
whole...
very lazy.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, you guys all knew each other back then. What did we do? Well, you played together and had the same relationships you do now.
It's like, thanks. So glad we got this valuable insight.
Oh man, this was absolutely necessary to understand what's going on right now.
I couldn't have just assumed this and continued on with life. It's not like an awful chat. It's just weird and kind of lazy. I guess I'm kind of excited to see Sting fight. I don't know. I'm not excited or unexcited. He's just such a, like, tertiary character to me at this point because he doesn't really ever get to do all that much.
Remember that one time when it looked like Rogue was going to be, like, a big villain and a shadow crept up on him and then Gray was like, Frosh, you're super cute. And the evil shadow went away.
God, that was such a lame way of handling that plot thread. God, that was dumb.
All right. Oh, man.
So that's Fairy Tail this week. I guess we'll just have to wait to see what comes out of this.
All right, let's move on to Shokugeki no Soma. It's chapter 191, A Passion. A Passionate Battle's End. And we should go ahead and point out that they're still conducting the popularity poll for Shokugeki no Soma, and Tropical actually point out to us that you can actually vote on this poll even though it's taking place in Japan, because you can go on shonenjump.com/vote_Shokugeki, and if you can navigate through the Japanese-only text page, then you can actually vote for a character. But there are helpful portraits in case the... In case you have difficulty actually getting there.
The thing, I was trying to do this. The issue I have is that you didn't need to fill out information. And I don't know what they're asking for. I assume it's like obvious, like name, location, shit like that. But I had no idea.
Yeah. You just use Google's auto translate if you use Chrome. And you can basically navigate through that if you just do that.
Yeah. So keep that in mind. If you want to vote for it, feel free to go ahead. shonenjump.com/vote_Shokugeki.
And also, there is even an option for you to enter like a lottery to get one of two different posters. One which is really nice and actiony, and the other which features three of the female leads and doing like, oh, are you going to fuck us?
Definitely. Oh, our tiny geishas are just falling right off of us.
Oh, no.
Off of our voluptuous teenage bodies.
By the way, this
manga is about steak and shit.
It's a pretty thorough character list, though, I'd say. You've got, like, all the Polar Star dorm characters. You got the old members of the Council of Ten and the other people in Central. Sheila and Berta are on there. And then there's, like, really obscure ones that I don't recognize in the slightest who showed up, like, in the early chapters or in, like, there's, like, the reporter kid who was there during the Fall Classic. So it's a pretty damn thorough list that there is a write-in option if you want that.
There you go.
Anyway, so we, start off this chapter where we left off last time with, Soma offering Hayama, one more, sample of his dish. Hayama eats it and his clothes like explode off and he can feel it. He can feel the effort and passion that you can hear pour into the dish flowing through him. So he, you know, now agrees with what Dojima said, you know, that he lost sight of the reasons why he would cook, but Yukihira did not. I was busy shunning everyone and shutting myself up in my own little world. And he never took his eyes off his opponent, off me and everything he could to make his dish better. Unlike me, all I could think to do was sacrifice more of myself for a goal I'd already thrown away. He looks down, and June's suddenly there. It's like, oh wait, you're here. You're actually here. This is a food illusion. And Hayama tries to be all sensitive. It's like, why'd you come here? Why'd you want to see me so bad? And June just slaps him right across the face. I assume she has to reach up a good ways to do it, too, because she is...
She has a box. She just steps on...
Just steps off of the soapbox in order to reach it. So, Jun gives Hayama a pretty good stern talking to, saying, look, you know, I'm still your guardian, and this is just a clear demonstration that you need some freaking someone looking after you. You're still a minor. You don't have to feel responsible for what goes on between us adults. And Hayao makes a point of being like, hey, don't treat me like a kid, June. And they argue pretty loudly back and forth for a little bit. Eventually she says, I don't need the seminar anymore. Instead of worrying about getting back our budget or equipment or whatever, there's something I'd much rather see you do. Rather than lab work, what I want to see most is you enjoying your cooking and hanging out with your friends your age, spending time together, studying, working, and having fun. So, essentially, what we get here is that things don't all come out sneaky clean for Hayama. Sneaky clean? Squeaky clean for Hayama. He is basically not going to get backed by Azami, and he is going to lose the Shiomi seminar, but she's just like, nah, it's okay.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
You're more important. Yeah, so... So I like that as opposed to, well, we'll make sure that you can win back stuff for the Shiomi seminar. It's like, no, there is a loss that happened here, and there was a maturing process that had to happen. Mm-hmm. And of course, we get the final judge decision, which is that Soma wins, which is portrayed as if Soma is an angel from on high bequeathing basically a meat bun to Hayama in order to give him this grand revelation.
The term bequeathing. Bequeathing upon you.
So...
it's an image right there.
Soma feels a sense of triumph, too. He thinks back to the struggles that he had trying to catch Hayama during the Fall Classic. Now finally he surpassed him. He gets his big victory pose while whipping his headband off. And then there's a little moment of reality because Jun's like, well, if we don't have the Shiomi seminar, then I guess we're kind of homeless. So someone just says, well, you guys can come stay at the Polar Star dorm. You know, we're basically guaranteed to be okay, and I'll just, you know, talk to Fumio, and then I'm sure that she'll be okay with you guys living there, especially since June is used to live there. So, I think everything's going to be fine. And Puga's followers are like, oh, this is so great! Power of friendship! And Puga's like, eh, I guess the power of friendship's okay every once in a while. Such a weird, dismissive thing to do.
He's like, fuck it. I guess friendship's fine sometimes.
Like, Kuga needs to show up in Black Clover or Fairy Tail occasionally. He's like, yeah, I guess Nakama's fine occasionally.
Or he, like, shows up, like, because I imagine he's like, I guess it's okay for once. Well, I want that contrarian opinion. Like, he shows up in Fairy Tail every so often, or he's like, the only way I'm going to win is with friendship. He's like, nukes. Nukes will work, too. Nukes are actually stronger than friendship.
Our friendship will cure this disease. Have you tried like antibiotics or?
He comes in with practical answers to things like, "How can I overcome the sensory deprivation power?" He's like, "I try getting away from her, seeing if her senses come back, and then maybe having someone else come in to help you out." She's like, "No, I haven't." He just breaks their minds. He's like, "Wait, a dragon's going to kill us, and our best course of action isn't to gather around a circle holding hands and singing songs of our friendship?"
This is something in your group. Something in your group have teleportation powers. Why don't you guys just use that to get away?
It's like, I've never thought of that before.
Nobody can get close to this person without feeling the effects of this sickness. How are we going to defeat them? Well, you could have Kana just shoot them from a long ways away. She's got the sniper magic powers.
Whoa,
shoot them with a friendship bullet? Well, I mean, I guess.
I mean, yeah, I guess there's no real limit to what she could do.
So, Soma yeses that, because Hayama brings up, I betrayed all of you guys by joining Central, so it was like, water under the bridge.
Whatevs, it happens.
So, you know, cut your ties with Central, come join us, and Hayama's like, yeah, thanks. Just that is enough to make it feel like I've been saved. So we're like, what the fuck are you talking about? Meanwhile, elsewhere, other stage 3 exams are also coming to close. Just when we had this all, oh yay, they're friends again, everything's gonna work out just fine. When we now learn that Ikumi, Isami Aldini, and Hisako have all been defeated by other members of the Council of Ten, and so they're gonna get expelled. Oh shit.
Yeah, it's like a real weird, not weird, it's an interesting whiplash in that you kind of go from being like, okay, cool, like, Hayama's learned humility, we're getting him and June are back together, he's gonna start living at Polaris Dorm, like, good, you know, it's nice to see everything's gonna work out for everybody I like. And then you cut over to the next fucking page, and it's like, oh, hey, you know that thing that other people are fighting, the other Council of Ten members? Yeah, there's no gimmick to that. They just lose to them and are expelled. And it's pretty significant, the ones they show, because they're all very relevant people, especially to our protagonists. You know, we see Aldini, who's being brought up as one of the bigger characters right now. His brother's in there. Hisako. Who is Erina's essentially assistant and best friend, is in there. And Ikumi, who is starting to get some real focus, American Flag Bikini Girl, she's eliminated too. And she had just recently had a moment with Erina, kind of talking about like the similarities of their life and, you know, how they both kind of struggled. So it's not like they were like, oh no, we got rid of Meat Bun Hair Girl and the fucking, like, Polaris Bro guys. Like, it's like, no, these are significant characters.
The Polaris guys.
Yeah, these are guys who they just got rid of. I mean, we still have to see more, because presumably if these fights just happened outright, then you have to think most of the other ones did too. And remember, Rindo was apparently going to be the one challenging Megumi and Aldini.
That's something that because last time I was thinking that maybe Hayama was assigned to Soma specifically because Azami is targeting him. But now I'm thinking, what if they were specifically assigned so that the weaker members of the resistance had to go up against the stronger members of the council? Because you look at these guys, Tsukasa is number one. Momo, three, and sword guy, Soma, they were the fourth and fifth seats before things shifted. So these are three of the five strongest members of the council going up against, come on, Aldini's younger brother.
The fatter Aldini brother.
You really need Tsukasa to beat this guy.
If I was him and I fucking, they're like, you're going up against a Council of Ten member and fucking Tsukasa walks through the door, first I shit my pants. Second of all, I'm just like, you win. I give up. What, this is ridiculous. It's like you were like, hey, we're going to give you a match to decide whether or not you're going to get entered into the football, like you're going to get the NFL. And the fucking, like, who are you going to be against? And the fucking, like, 2007 New England Patriots come out. You're like, oh, this is fucking unfair.
Oh, who do I get to play? Who do I get to play for me? The Denver Broncos!
I think the Denver Broncos are a great team to have.
Oh, Marge, you don't know anything about football.
I love it, like the ball's bouncing off their head, like, whoa! But yeah, like, that's...
What, you mean like with Von Miller? No, 90s Denver Broncos.
Yeah, it's a rough draw for that guy.
Pre-design change for Denver Broncos. So... My new theory here is that I think the strategy is actually just to chip away at who they can get rid of now. That's probably the priority. I think that, because, you know, you proposed when someone was on the phone with Alice and Kirikiba that, oh, well, maybe they're going to lose. I honestly think that this probably actually increases their chances of getting through this, because at the very least we know they're not going up against one of the four remaining strongest members of the council. For all we know, it's going to end up that they have to go up against Kinokuni, who, you know, yeah. That's no joke. But this is really interesting, and I think that you definitely see it on something where it looks like they might be going after, like, the support system, going after Erina's closest advisor, going after Takumi's younger brother. Maybe they're trying to get rid of the chuff in order to get rid of the dead wood, and also these people who, you know, that are connected to the stronger members of the resistance. And then they could be like, well, you know, maybe this will help to convince the stronger members to actually bend to our will. And yeah, Rindo is the second seat, and she is going up against Megumi and Takumi. But she's also really moody. And we were proposing, like, well, maybe she won't actually go through with it. And that's entirely possible still. Just based on the fact that Yoshi is constantly complaining about how Azami is doing things, like how he got rid of the three members who weren't on board with them, and so on, and like that. So, but the fact that we actually have finalized, okay, three members of the Resistance are actually expelled as of right now, then that actually opens up a bunch of other possibilities, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely, like, right now is where the point where I'm, like, most kind of curious to find out what happens next, because it's definitely not now at a point where I could just, like, oh, well, let's just see. You know, I'm so good at predicting these things at this point. Like, obviously, it's not the case.
Can you imagine? It's just like the Polaris bros were like, oh, dude, it was sweet. The Council of Ten member we got was Arina, and she wasn't there, so we went by default.
She forgot to show up, man. Bruh, awesome. Boom.
Yeah, that's it for Food Wars. Let's move on to My Hero Academia, which also had a test wrapping up recently. This honestly kind of takes an unexpected turn because there's no follow-up on the provisional license exam. There's no real follow-up on the revelation that Toga could disguise herself and was in disguise as Kamiya from Shiketsu. Instead, we get a character chapter.
Yeah.
And it was an unexpected one, too. The reveal happens pretty late in the chapter. And when it happened, I was like, what, really? Well, I guess that makes sense, given what was happening during the chapter. But really? This is a very different kind of feeling than what you're introduced with them.
Yeah, this is a very interesting chapter for My Hero. Okay, say that at least before we get into it.
So we open up with this guy looking out his window. He's just thinking to himself, and he's narrating to himself. And occasionally, as he's doing it, we get a narration box, which is colored in kind of black instead of white, providing a contradictory point of view on things. And so, you know, he's looking outside, he's like, you know, knowing who you are is what really matters. And strolling off to work with a satisfied expression, that's not good. Well, I think it's lovely. And he's contradicting himself like that through the entire chapter. While he's listening to the news, he hears Miyagi, this guy who was on the news, discussing what's happening with the crime rates since All Might has been forced to retire. So he's looking at things in a very, you know, calm kind of perspective, which is, yeah, we're going to see big changes, and we should look into how those changes are going to present themselves and what we can do to prepare. You know, very... A very matter-of-fact way of dealing with what's a crisis. And so the guy is like, you're different, Miyagi, and I respect that. I don't! And he thinks also about Endeavor, how Endeavor is not the kind of person that people are going to flock to the way All Might was, because Endeavor just has this sense of unease about him. He's a little bit too violent. In comparison to All Might, who is the big... It's like if Batman had to replace Superman, let's just say. Like that. Not in terms of ability, but in terms of outlook. He's thinking to himself while he's heading out the door, and also he witnesses a supervillain robbing a bank. It looks like he just runs out with an ATM, I think. I'm not sure exactly. But people are trying to stop him. A hero steps in to try and save the day, but it turns out the supervillain has help. And they're like, we're the Reservoir Dogs gang!
Now, this is where I...
Where are your suits, guys? Where are your suits?
This is where I probably make myself sound really dumb, but is Reservoir Dogs a term beyond... like the movie?
I'm not really sure, honestly.
Is that just a phrase or something? I've never heard it and referenced anything but the movie, but I'm curious if that's a reference to the movie or not.
I don't know. Let's see here. It's an American film. Blah, 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 blah. Blah, 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 blah. How did Reservoir Dogs get its name? He called it the Reservoir Film to avoid saying it. Blah, 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 blah. Supposedly the title came from Tarantino's inability to pronounce au revoir le tien during his day as a video store clerk. He called it the Reservoir Film to avoid saying it. He joined this with the part of Pickens Paws Straw Dogs. So no.
Okay. Well, there we go.
No. So yeah, it's just a straight up Tarantino reference, but they do not follow the look at all. No, where are their suits?
Yeah, Mr. Blue bitching about a Madonna movie, then like dying in the movie off screen. I love that dude had a bigger role in the fucking video game than he did in the actual movie.
Here's a Reservoir Dogs game.
Yeah.
Suddenly, the guy is contacted by a man named Jiren, who just asks him a series of questions, like, oh, how you doing? Oh, no, I can't tell whether I'm doing well or not. Oh, that sounds rough. What are you doing? And the guy says, like, oh, yeah, you know, we've had a whole demand for costumes and accessories through the black market, thanks to the League of Villains. So we're doing actually pretty darn well. You guys are doing really well. Thanks for doing that. He keeps on pressing him while he's trying to escape the conversation by saying stuff like, I'm really busy over here. No, I'm not. I've got nothing but free time. Jiren says that he's been trying to get in touch with Dobby, because Shigaraki wants to round up the whole gang again, and they're probably going to actually reach out and get in contact with him. And, as he continues to lose control over his other side, the guy hangs up, and he just has this kind of freak out in an alleyway. What's going on? I'm me. We cut away to Dobby coming across. I believe this is supposed to be the same gang that just robbed the bank. And he lights him up, because we don't need types like you.
Yeah.
Setting higher standards for villains.
Yeah.
We cut around to see various members of the League of Villains just scattered around. Then we catch up to the man who is revealed to be twice the guy who could double everything and who contradicted himself, who tugs his mask on. And as he does so, he says, with this on, I become one. And he starts to explain in narration, my quirk is double. I can make one thing into two. It's a really simple power. I'd make a clone of myself, and that clone would make another. Before I knew it, I had a whole team of doubles assembled. I had my doubles do all sorts of things, and I was their king. In the end, we weren't too happy about me being king. That nearly got me killed by me. Whatever I doubled wouldn't go away until it took a certain amount of damage. We all started arguing about who was the original. Can you picture it? That insanity continued for a full 9 days. It ended when my doubles mastered each other and vanished. And since then, I've never been quite sure if I'm the real me.
This is, I mean, look, this is interesting. This, like, just even considering that is, like, kind of sad and tragic in a way. Like, you have to, this guy is never going to truly know anymore because Sandy has slipped away if he's the real or if he's a duplicate of the original self. It's just sort of strange because it's like, this is really dark for My Hero Academia. Like, it's surprising.
Well, and also just for this character who was previously, like, the wacky member of the League of Villains.
Yeah, I mean, I can almost understand them giving them some context, though, because that is something that we've seen throughout, even, like, with the heroes, that characters who initially started off just as one-off jokes are starting to get more and more development. So I'm not surprised we get a development for them. I'm just surprised it's so, like, dark and kind of almost, not morbid, but just kind of, like, bleak. You know, it's not like he has some whack, it's not like he's Two-Face, where it's like, oh, well, he has this whole duplicating gimmick, and, I don't know, he lives two lives. It's like, no, he's slowly losing his sanity, because he doesn't know if he's a copy of his original self or not, and after they all killed themselves in front of him, he doesn't, you know, he's sort of lost his mind and keeps the mask on so he can believe that he's staying together as one. It's like, damn, all right, fair enough.
Twice comes across the wreckage of the getaway vehicle for the bank robbers, which has been set upon by some more villains, some new villains who look to be considerably more serious than them. The face of the guy that was had actually grabbed the ATM is part of a tire now. It's kind of hard to tell exactly what's happening. It's like, because, you know, there would be a hole there, wouldn't there? So is he merged with the tire now? Is it just an indent of his face? What happened with that? I don't know, but it looks creepy because his face is just kind of going, ah, sticking out of it.
Yeah.
And one of the guys who destroyed the vehicle is just says, all they can think to do is rob a convenience store. You think a group this big might have bigger goals than that? You're all sick and you need a cure. And they've stolen the money from the guys who stole the money to begin with. So, Twice just thinks to himself, because he has said, you know, there's no place for insane people like me in society, but those jobs now are starting to carve out a place for themselves in this world. And so he thinks to himself if he should ask the guys to join the Society of Villains now that he has discovered them. And then we cut away to something that was occurring while Class A was taking the provisional license exam. Where All Might has decided to visit All For One to settle things, apparently. And it's a big, almost two-page spread of them separated by thick glass casing as All Might is visiting in prison. And, of course, All For One is all bound up. And, interestingly, All Might is actually in All Might suit, despite the fact that he's not muscled up. He's here as All Might.
Yeah, I did find that kind of curious, but maybe there's some explanation to that.
So, yeah. Very interesting chapter, I'd say.
What'd you think of the chapter, Nick?
I thought it was interesting. It definitely caught me off my guard to have a chapter like this and also focus on the character that it did. I thought that if there were any single character that we were not going to get a chapter focusing on, it would probably be either Twice or the Lizard Guy. One of those two. But this is good, though, because, you know, if the Society of Villains is going to be, you know, our villains going forward, then we're going to need to know more about them than just what they look like and what their powers can do.
Yeah, that is a good point. Like, it helps if we're going to have... It also helps because it makes it clear that this group isn't just going to be, like, the two or three really notable members of that. Like, it's not just going to be Toga and Dobby and that's it. Like, it seems like we're going to get more out of everybody.
Yeah, Toga, Dobby, and then Shigaraki. And all the rest, you know.
But yeah, it's a really interesting chart. It's also kind of interesting because there's no prompt for this. Like, it's not like, you know, it's not like fucking, what's his name, actually? Like, I know his power's double. Like, I'm trying to remember what his actual name is.
Twice?
Okay. It's not like Twice showed up at the end of last chapter. It's not like he shows up in this chapter. It's, like, almost a one-off chapter just here to kind of explain things. And then, like, at the end, it's like, all right, and now here's where the story is going from here. Again, still not involving Twice, but it's just kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess let's move on to, because there is no One Piece this week, we'll
Teardrop.
Head on to Promised Neverland, right?
Yep, that is correct.
Okay, so it's Chapter 15, Never Again. So Ray has just told Norman to trick Emma so that the three of them and potentially also Dawn and Gilda can escape, but they'll abandon the rest of the kids. And Norman is, of course, contemplating what he's going to do. Of course, he's thinking, like, no, I'm not going to do that. I want to fulfill Emma's wishes, and I won't give up on taking everyone. So I have to pretend to trick Emma and instead trick Ray. It'll be fine. I can do it. And then he has a nightmare where he sees all the other kids dead. Yeah. How terrifying.
He has a bit of a morbid fucking dream.
Well, because all the kids have, you know, no pupils in their eyes. They've got the flowers growing out of them. And then he dreams of Ray's lifeless body coming, you know, falling down behind him and going, "I told you." And he holds Emma and Ray's corpses together. He's like, "Wake up, wake up." And then he's a demon bearing down on him. So, yeah. And then he's woken up in his bed by some of the younger kids, and he immediately has to be like, "Oh yeah, good morning," and give them a hug and pretend like nothing's wrong.
"I didn't have dreams about you guys all dying."
"Everything's fine."
It'd be great, like, conversation at breakfast. It's like, "I know we've never done this before. What did everyone dream about last night? Ray, let's start with Norman, let's start with you. Candy! You dreamt about candy? Giant candies talking and fighting, crying. Next person." Phew, saved it. Nobody suspects anything.
So, we see them all taking the test, and Norman is preoccupied, trying to think about what he's going to do. He's like, "I've got to get Ray to cooperate. I've also got to get Emma what she wants. I can't make a single mistake, or else, God, it's going to be impossible to do this. Now I know I've got Ray working against me, and Mom, and the sister getting in the way." So he's trying to think of what to do. He's like, "Yeah, Ray is my trump card. If I can use him to take everyone, we can all at the very least escape from here. This is huge. How can I have us all escape without Ray finding out?" And the test ends, and we proceed to have a very unusual chapter of Promised Neverland, where it suddenly gets very comedic for most of this.
Yeah.
We get Mom congratulating the three main kids because they've got perfect scores again. And then she knows that Gilda and Don, your scores went up. And Phil, you too. And this little gremlin with a happy face going, "Yay!" There's this little tyke with no nose because his happy face is too big. And then she very creepily bends down towards Don and Gilda and is like, "Keep up the good work." And they're like, "Woman who wants to sell us off." And then she goes over to Phil, "Good job." And he's like, "Yay! I did great!" So we fast forward to during outdoor playtime, and Emma says, "So did we find out who the source of information was?" And Ray goes, "Oh yeah, it was me."
I do like, well, I like it because he twists it immediately. Like, he's immediately like, it was me. Well, because we kind of time skip a little bit. Like, the explanation doesn't happen, but it's clear that the way Ray explains it isn't nearly as sinister as it sounded with Norman. He explains it as like, "Yeah, I was going to tell you guys, like, but you guys kind of fuck things up. But, you know, I'm still on your side. I just happened to be the informant for Mom, and I couldn't tell you because it would kind of throw things off."
Yeah, he makes the excuse that you left the little bunny behind and started saying you wanted to take everyone along, so this was all unexpected. And if you hadn't done that, yeah, I would have just told you guys when you came back from the gate after you knew the truth, and then we would have been able to escape and so on. But in the midst of all this, we get so many wacky faces. So many wacky faces. We get a wacky face from Norman because Ray just like, he's like, "What?" And then we get Emma reacting. He's like, "Ah!" And then she's like, "What are you talking about?" There's all these weird faces and just this general tone that we haven't really seen in Promised Neverland, because there's been this overwhelming sense of dread covering everything where, you know, the slightest error could mean doom for everyone. And we have this much lighter chapter suddenly to kind of relax things a little bit, which is an unusual feeling for the series because I'm so used to every single chapter of Promised Neverland being very tense and intense.
Everything feeling like it's getting more and more serious and you know, dramatic, and feeling like, you know, the only way to do this chapter is to add another twist upon things. Like,
and we do get some more moments of tension in this because Emma is kind of suspicious about what's going on because Ray offers this whole explanation of, you know, "Mom found out about this, so I had to change the situation." And, don't worry. Everything is different now. Norman figured out I was a traitor and convinced me that, yeah, I should help you to escape with everyone. So we're all on the same page now. And Emma goes, what's that like you, Ray, though? You're like, what? Well, you see, if you don't change your mind at something early on, usually you never do. So Norman's like, oh, no. So you, I think he's lying then. Emma's like, no, I'm happy because it's out. But, this also concerns me because you knew everything for a long time, and it must have been tough knowing about this, knowing what was happening to us, and still letting all those kids go away for years. So I just want to ask something, the tracking devices, does that mean you experimented on the ear of one of our siblings? And Graves got a poker face, and Norman's like, I didn't even think of that. But it would, of course, make sense.
Yeah.
Ray has been in Mom's pocket this whole time. What if he used that to his advantage to try and plan his escape? What if, he knew that this kid was going to go away, so he's like, this kid's dead now. Might as well experiment on the tracking device.
Well, it's the one thing, too. Remember, he was the one that immediately volunteered when the plan was like, how do we get rid of these tracking devices? He's like, don't worry about that. I'll handle that. And we never got more context of what he was planning to do. I mean, at that point, I think they had only just found out the tracking devices, where they were.
Yeah. And so Emma just flat out says, did you sacrifice someone for our sake? But before he can answer, she says, you know what? No, it's okay. Now because of that, all the rest of us can get away. But, and she takes his hand and stares into his soul and says, never sacrifice one of us like that again.
It's weird because it's like you just, it's almost kind of like a creepy thing. It is creepy, but it's a sentiment that you're like, oh, this would, in other series, this would be like the inspire, like you'd have be like a fucking like fireworks going off behind them because that's how noble and inspiring that sentiment is. With this one, it's like she's losing her mind. Like, never sacrifice anyone of us again. It's like, okay. I guess maybe even Emma's not all together anymore.
And she's very obviously, because we get a focus on the Wraith looking down his hand being clutched by her. You can tell she's trembling and kind of squeezing it. But she starts to get emotional after that by saying, like, but you're not alone anymore. So she can't finish before Ray says, nope, I swear, I'll never do it again. Scout's honor.
I fucking love, like, she runs away, and Ray's like, Emma sure was bad. And he has, like, fucking shark teeth. Like, he's got such, like, an insidious, like, she sure was angry. I'm such a skank.
Well, Norman says, she held it in, though, because she understands how you must have felt fighting alone for so long. So, yeah, she was emotional about it, but, her empathy for you kind of saved you from getting your ass kicked. So.
Yeah, and I mean, it actually does kind of make sense. I think they mentioned on the Jump podcast, but they're like, it's actually kind of interesting too that like she goes and grabs his hand, making that kind of physical contact does help to kind of like make the connection more emotional than what otherwise it might be for Ray.
So no reason at that point, which I was surprised he didn't really bring up last time, which is, how did you find out the secret anyway? And, how have you been feeling these past 6 years? You said you did this to not get us both killed, but actually, but Emma distracts them and, because she calls over to them after she's gone off to some of the other kids. I got something to tell you guys when we get back to the house. Kind of grabs them. It's like, oh, let's go training again. Time passes, and Emma says that she and Gilda. Sorry,
think like Golda, like from Fiddler on the Roof. Isn't Golda a character from that?
I don't know.
Fiddler on the Roof. Golda.
Gilda. Emma Gilda have been.
Yeah, Golda. Okay. Not crazy.
Don and Gilda have been observing Mom, and they say that Mom disappears right before 8 o'clock every night. They can't find her anywhere in the house when that happens, which means that there must be a secret room in the facility that they don't know about. Presumably the radio room that we've seen her in before.
Well, there we go. We still get one at the end of the chapter, still moving the plot forward in like a, ooh, interesting kind of way. But, yeah, this was kind of a unique chapter. You don't see that. We haven't seen this side of Emma before, and it's intimidating.
Yeah. But it's also in keeping with her being the emotional one out of the three of them, too.
I do like how their roles are becoming more and more defined now. So, really good chapter.
Yeah, like dug it. Let's move on to Red Sprite.
And I have to eat a lot of shit for this chapter. I'm like, Nick, don't worry about it. We're not going to have to go back and see Al for a while. This really felt like Al will show up again somewhere down the line and team up sort of thing. It's definitely not going to show up in the next chapter because the fucking Army Nation attacks and Tatsu shows up to save him. That's definitely not going to happen.
Yeah, I think that we're in like fast forward mode for Red Sprite because Yagi is pretty sure that he might get canceled if he doesn't pick up the pace. So we get a flashback to open this chapter of Beatrix's father, the king's funeral. Alfred, in his younger days, approaches Beatrix, and Beatrix is just like, I don't need your condolences. You know, you're an outsider. What do you know about our country? And Alfred says, look, I love this country, so I promise that I will protect it. And with that, we come back to the present with, of course, the army converging on Edinia, right, knocking at their door. And the general is still like, Your Majesty, please evacuate. No.
That's what you get when you put a fucking, like, 7-year-old in charge of your kingdom.
No!
God damn it.
So, the attack begins. Shells get launched towards the wall of the city, but Alfred appears in order to deflect them, and the general's like, oh my god, that idiot stayed behind. So, we get more flashback to, even further back, when Alfred, like, first arrived, at the country, being taken in by the general, and the general just being like, no, it'll be fine, you know, we can just hide him. So much for that plan, of course. And the general telling Alfred, you know, this is your home now, this is your town, so live your life here. And first meeting Beatrix, and Alfred's reaction was somewhat akin to Tatsu's, because like, oh, hey, little kid, are you lost? He's just kind of putting his hand on her
head. It's like, I rule you.
Who are you? Alfred is trying to haul off the army, and he's doing a fairly good job of it, although he's clearly pressed really hard, and they're like, oh, he could do it. No, they haven't gotten serious yet. But at that moment, a cloaked figure comes zipping in, snatches Alfred, and throws a cloak over him as a huge lightning bolt descends from the sky and just starts frying the enemy army. And everyone's like, what the hell's going on? And Tatsu says, well, I know I didn't tell you about all this, but this was actually a diversion for our main plan, so good job, Alfred. And he explains that this is their super special awesome technique, Mono Thunder, where they just hook Mono up to a huge lightning rod and have him rain hell on the ground. And what he threw over Alfred was an insulating cloak so that they wouldn't get electrocuted by this. So Alfred, of course, is angry that Tatsu didn't just run away. You know, he says, you guys are going to be able to escape now. And Tatsu says, well, Magonia never abandoned his citizen. No matter what anyone says, you are one of them. But you think of the people here as your family. Now, I'll be honest, the family of our family, or in other words, relatives. So there's an obligation for us to protect now, beyond. I like his logic.
Seems to work. Makes sense.
And he also says, you know, I don't plan on dying here. There's only one path to take. We must defeat the Edinian army here. And he launches a signal. More lightning comes raining down on the enemy army as Tatsu basically skirts over them in his insulating cloak, directing Mono's attack. Basically, they have almost won, but one of the soldiers starts to do something, and what this means is that there are many different Blasmero soldiers that have gathered, and they have an Ash soldier. Okay.
It's a big deal, apparently.
I guess, yes. As this weirdly half-corpse-like man appears, like it's only a skeleton at first, and his flesh starts to grow over him along with his uniform, and he's introduced as the Ash Soldier Blackburn. So, the big boss has emerged because we defeated enough regular opponents first.
Yeah, it's a relatively interesting chapter. We'll see if it's going to keep up this pace or if it gets canceled. So he's like, hey, I found my five other friends here in this room. They were all being kept in the same place.
They were just in the back of the ship.
Like, wow, it seems kind of weird. You didn't know that. Heck, go ahead, time. Fair enough, though. So,
I liked it.
I'll talk about Ruby then here. Ruby chapter 3. I'm going to apologize in advance, because this chapter focuses entirely upon a character whose name is German. And as we recall, entirely from when we did Vinland Saga, and most recently when Liesht became a fucking bad guy in Black Clover, we apparently don't have a good, at least I don't have a very good track record pronouncing, like, European names. And I mentioned this on Twitter, like, I said, like, oh man, she's just gonna forever be known as Rapier Girl to me, because I don't know how to pronounce that name. People were like, let me tell you how to pronounce it. And they'd send me the fucking, like, German word. And I'm like, I don't know how to pronounce the weird-ass B that you're sending me. You need to give me, like, a phonetics guide then at that point. So.
I'd just say it like Vice, like Miami Vice.
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 Can't just call her fucking White Snow. That's her fucking name.
No, that's racist.
That's what her name means.
I know it is.
All right, so Whitey over here. This is about Weiss.
Because the four characters are, what, red, white, blue, and yellow, right?
Red, white, black, and yellow, basically, yeah.
Now that's racist.
The black one's the criminal of the group, Nick. Well, no, because it's also, heavily inspired off of fairy tales. You know, the main character's Red Riding Hood. The creatures are called Grimms. This character's Snow White, essentially. I don't know what the other two are supposed to be based off fairy tales. Probably are. Don't care. Anyway, this one's about Weiss. And she is, I guess, the second, like, major character in the group. From what I've gathered from my odd osmosis of the show, I guess she's more like kind of a little bit of a rival figure. To Ruby's naive innocence, she's the Seto Kaiba, the talented, expert, super smart, super rich character. And it starts off with a bunch of people watching Weiss as a child playing a very, very tiny piano, and everybody saying, oh, Miss Schnee, is there nothing you're not good at? You're singing, you're piano playing, it's all wonderful. You have quite the future of playing tiny little pianos at times and singing along with it. And Weiss is essentially giving us a dialogue about, like, I was always praised. You know, whatever I did, no matter how little effort I put into it, I was always better than average. I expected praise as a matter of course, and I believed I deserved it all, because I was the daughter of the Schnee house, and I would be the best. Nothing else would do. My father felt the same way, so his indifference was expected. And we get, like, a almost two-page spread of her that I believe is supposed to be based off of the, like, intro thing, teaser that they initially put out. I think that's one of the few things of Ruby I've actually seen before, which showed off her power, which is very, like, video gamey, kind of like people who are fans of the genre clearly being the ones who are making up the powers, because it's very strange and, like, kind of obtuse. Like, she has, I guess, glyphs is part of her power as well. She can, like, make glyphs and kind of bounce around and shit. And she has a rapier with, like, a spinny revolver in it, which can do different things depending, I guess, on what it lands on. And the scientist kind of going over this experiment while she's in the danger room even notes that, like, oh, your semblance and your ability to summon glyphs is so impressive, and your multi-action dust rapier, Marentinaster, was it? You have such a mastery of such a complex weapon. And she's like, whatevs, I'm awesome, get on with it. I want to attend the Beacon Academy, and my father said that if I want to, I had to prove myself, essentially. And basically, the scientist is going on as she explains why she wants to be the huntress and go to Beacon. So they're like, all right, well, we'll test you. And they release a giant, like, suit of armor. I guess it has nothing in it. It's a grim, apparently, of some form. They're like, this one is an amalgamation of smaller-sized grims we've successfully captured. They are humanity's nemesis, depraved monsters. And we just keep them in a box to, I don't know, throw at you. And the scientist is like, yeah, it's your job to slay Grimm, so do it. And she does, essentially. She's like, come on, sword! And then she kicks its ass, dances around. If you want to see, I guess, the actual version of it, I'd suggest watching the video. Because you don't get much of the sense of what she can actually do off of these, like, 2 pages of action. But she kills the shit out of it, and as she's doing it, she's like, I knew it. I'm already bored. That's the chapter. So, I guess this is our first look into Weiss, but, it's sort of a, not weird, because it's establishing, and, you know, it's an annoying character archetype, the person who's so perfect and is bored of how perfect they are, but I assume there's growth. Yeah, see, she's not a super fucking bitch as well on top of it. I'll be real pissed off if Weiss has another flashback where she's like, oh, my house was ruined, but thank God this other person was here to grow up and make sacrifice, so I didn't have to lose anything. But no, like, you know, we kind of need this, I guess, to start things off, but it is sort of a weird beginning because you don't get a lot to find Weiss likable at the beginning. I don't know, maybe that's what you're supposed to do for a while. I don't know if she gets likable later on or what. Yeah, I guess this is also going to be a series about all of the cast, or at least 2 of them, because why have an entire chapter focused on just her if she's not going to be focused upon the fucking prequel series or whatever this is? I still don't know what the fuck this series is. That's Ruby. It's kind of fun.
Okay, well, let's finish up with Toriko, the penultimate chapter. It's Gourmet 395, everyone gathered around the table. So we open with Komatsu and Toriko visiting Midora's grave, which is surrounded by food instead of flowers because Toriko.
He's like, can't eat flowers? Well, you can't eat a couple of flowers, I guess.
You can eat some. You can eat daffodils, I guess.
He's like, there's that cotton candy flower. I'm going to go get a bouquet of those.
So, they get a call suddenly from Rin, that, oh yeah, it's time for their wedding banquet. Jeez, Toriko. Be more timely. Your bride-to-be is waiting, and she's not any more mature now than she was at the start of the fucking manga. If anything, she may have gotten worse. Oh god. So yeah, Toriko shows up, at the Hotel Gourmet. Rin is there waiting in her wedding gown, which is partially made of food, because Toriko.
Well, hold on. He says, that's an amazing dress. Is it edible? And she says, one part is. And I'm like, did she just admit she's wearing fucking edible underwear? Because that definitely feels like the insinuation.
In the Toriko universe, why would you wear any underwear to your wedding that wasn't edible? Seriously.
Oh my god, I want Toriko to start eating her fucking underwear. And he goes on for like an hour and a half about how fucking delicious it is. He's like, oh, the flavors of their underwear swirling around in my mouth. She's like, are you gonna go at it? Or he's like, no, there's so many flavors to dissect and digest. Oh, Komatsu, get in here. Taste my wife's underwear. It's like a train of characters coming in for a taste of her fucking underwear. She's just sitting there like, God, this was a mistake.
This is a bad idea.
It's like, I don't know why I thought this was a good idea.
Toriko, are you sure there's not something else you want to eat there? What?
She's like, no, my appetite has been sated. She's just there with like a magazine.
Really?
Wow. All right, I guess this is just how this is going to go.
Okay. I guess this is my life now.
She starts crying. She's like, God damn it.
Why did I make this mistake?
I hate you so much, Toriko.
And she's, God, like, it's so awkward because Toriko's like, oh, yeah, you look great, Rin. And Rin's like, yes, tell me I'm beautiful, Toriko, tell me. Oh, yeah, okay, you're beautiful. Yay! Jesus Christ.
Hey, good for her that she's finding happiness, though, you know?
It's just so weird, though, where, you know, Rin's like, I married the man of my dreams. Toriko's like, yeah, this is cool.
I feel like Toriko never expresses any, like, emotion towards somebody unless it's Komatsu. In which case, he's like, I would go to hell to get you back. You want to know what Robin Williams did for his wife and fucking What Dreams May Come? I would do that times 1,000.
Like, oh, man.
All right. Getting kind of weird, dude.
So, a bunch of guests are there. Like, what, every character in Toriko you can think of shows up at some point.
What, have some of my wife's underwear jerky?
And they're like, come on, let's get a move on, Toriko. We want to have a taste of your full course meal. And Toriko's like, yes, let's all eat together. And so they go inside a church. The cross is a fork and a knife going through the same chunk of meat,
yeah, like
in the shape of a cross.
Yeah, like one of those roasts fucking things that, like, they make in
so
video games.
So ridiculous. And the guy there I know has shown up before, but I don't remember where he's from. He's like, yes, do you solemnly swear to take this man and share a meal with him always forever? He's like, I do! In fullness and in hunger. It's like, and then everyone in the crowd suddenly starts going, wait a minute, who the fuck are you? Are you even a priest? And the guy says, you may now lay a full one on the bride.
I feel like this has to be, like, some liberal action taken on the part of the translation team, but I fucking love that he's like, lay a big one on her and do it until everyone gets their appetites. They managed to make far and away the most romantic moment in Toriko in years. Just, it's like the least romantic thing possible.
That's
like,
right, make out with this girl until all your guests get sick.
Yeah, make out with her until it's icky because she's a girl. Ew!
Why don't you go make out with Komatsu?
I'm like, this is 2 pages after you made a joke about edible underwear.
Oh my god. So everyone goes to this huge, like, they rented out a fucking a con hall for this banquet. It's just, it looks like it goes on forever, this banquet hall does.
Yeah, you can't even see the end of it. Like, you're seeing it from a perspective that clearly shows this thing is going on for miles and so.
Everyone is lost. Nobody knows where the fuck to go. People are just observing all these different people showing up. Star June is there. And someone is like, what the hell are you guys doing here, Gourmet Corps? And Star June says, I'm here because I was invited. I'm family. And it was like, what? I guess you did get the memo. Okay.
We're brothers.
And then we see, God, like, name a character in Toriko.
Everyone. There's even a fucking, like, Jedi fucking ghost moment where everyone, like, who's died is there, too. Even Neo has shown up in a fucking suit and tie, just going like,
Komatsu is there with, like, all the chefs. They're all working together to make the full course meal for everyone. And Take Inoue show up, and it's like, Take! And the other one!
Other Komatsu, but with a round nose? What the fuck? I didn't think he looked that much like Komatsu before.
Okay, we're on the second to last chapter now. We're on the second to last chapter. I know why we had Komatsu and Take, because Take joined up with the enemy. He didn't end up doing too much that was important, but he showed up at the end to help prepare Guy with Komatsu because he came around at the end. Why the fuck was Ume a thing? Was it literally just Shimabukuro wanted to make a joke about a group of three, the third of which is literally not important at all.
I thought it was originally because it was established like there were three factions. There was the Bushokuya, the Bushoku Kai, and then Neo. And there was a chef of Komatsu's group in all of them. And Ume was the one within Neo. But that never really developed or went anywhere. I don't know if it was an abandoned plot thread or if the Shirobukuro just kind of didn't want, feel like doing it anymore. But it was all kind of worth it for that explanation that came out later where it's like, I was working late and then I was so tired I was about to stop and I passed by and saw you there. And I realized I wanted to keep working. And then on my way back to my station, I saw that Ume was also around doing the same thing. And I was like, cool, thanks.
No, it's not even like, it wasn't even like that. It was literally, oh yeah, and Ume was there too.
And Ume was also working super late. It's like such an afterthought.
There's a comic called Casey and Andy, written by Andy Weir, the guy who did The Martian, where he relates the tale of trying to get a novel published to the guy, and the publisher advised that there weren't enough characters in it. So he considered just adding at the end of every third paragraph, Bob was there too.
Yeah.
Komatsu, you were there working late. Ume was there too.
So was Ume. He was everywhere. He was there when Natsu and Gazeel were fighting as young Dragon Slayer friends.
Sing was there too.
He was there when Sanji was put in prison. Like, I just want Ume to show up everywhere. He's like, I'm the other brother that no one likes.
He's like, he's Sanji's sixth brother.
Yeah, he's the sixth one. Just doesn't get a number. They didn't give him powers and no one hates him.
He's just my brothers would bully me while I was growing up because I was weaker than them. And Reiju kind of cared about me, but she didn't even move a muscle because she was too scared. Ume was there too. Tariko gives this big opening thing saying, it's like, oh, this is my Komatsu's full course meal, so enjoy it to your belly's content. And Rin suddenly brings up, and she points over to a low dining table, and she's like, what's that? Why is nobody sitting around it? It's like, okay, I call bullshit on this, because you fucking know that while Toriko was off saving the world, Rin was sending every waking moment preparing their wedding for when he got back. There is no fucking way she knows why a single flower is in one of the billions of vases in this room. She knows the meaning and explanation behind every single one. There is no way that she doesn't know why there's a table over there.
He's like, that's my ghost table. She's like, oh, right. not to like cut into this, but I just love the rest of this chapter.
It's so great.
This is an amazing end of it. Cause I mean, I don't want to, I guess, cut through, but it probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense to go
through. There's way too much to go through it, like page by page from this point forward. Yes, I agree.
It's essentially Toriko sharing his full course menu. And each time it's given out, they explain like what they did to this dish. And almost every time they've not only added, you know, the Toriko item, but some other menu item from the adventures Toriko has had. And as this is happening, Komatsu is cooking it, remembering all the various events and things that came with it. And he's like, oh, I remember I loved, you know, when the Toriko found the crayfish. It's been so delicious for me because that's when I first met him. And, you know, he thinks about the puffer fish and century soup and that moment they shared up at the Ozone. And it's just a wonderful thing of basically, like, it's a montage of Toriko, and it gives us an explanation of everything. And there's so many little beautiful details in it. Like,
yeah, stopping by with each dish to see some table of side characters reacting to it. Like, they explain, oh yeah, we use the legendary seasoning Milk Stardust on this, and Milk the Second is there, and she's just kind of quietly blushing because of she made an impact on this dish. And then, yeah, later on,
Century Soup, and you see Match, Tepe, mm-hmm. and Imaru kind of smiling as they're about to have it.
And Yuta is there, and he's thinking about when Komatsu had managed to prepare medicinal mochi, and he's preparing this other dish that Komatsu's made, and he's thinking that he really this.
Even like this is it's just so many small details to it. Like, you know, they serve the perfect elephant, and they're like, we served it with a little bit of meteor garlic, and it cuts over to the live bear, and he's like, oh, that makes me so happy. And it's truly and completely, because it's Komatsu cooking it and thinking about all the different adventures and all the ways these ingredients are important to him, just perfectly encapsulates what this series was about and, like, the emotion and kind of beauty behind it all.
And, we also, as this is going on, they stop by the table occasionally as the food spirits do begin to show up. First, just Ichijiro, and eventually it's Froze and Acacia, and then finally, at the very end, as everyone's getting super emotional as they proceed further and further into the dish, Midora shows up at the table, and he's finally reunited with his family in the afterlife. He's finally reunited with Froze, and they're able to dine together at the same table, at least when in death.
That shit's, like, gonna fucking make me cry. That shit's fucking so beautiful that he gets to share that.
And there's even a moment where, just before that, because they perfected the rainbow fruit, the first item that went on Torko's full course meal. And by this point, Komatsu is just a face masked by tears and snot as he's crying so hard, he's getting so emotional. And they've added more fruits to it in order to complement the rainbow fruit, including the world's stinkiest fruit that goes by the name Stink Bomb, the Durian Bomb. And everyone's kind of going, oh, it smells so bad. And Zonga's like, what smells about this? This is great.
I fucking love that Zonga of all people's like, this thing's great. It's so delicious. No downside to it.
I'll have seconds. Then, of course, finally, they have the Billy Brigade to finish off, and that's when Starjan at last arrives. And I love the note of it.
Midora.
Midora, not Starjan. I love the way it's portrayed, because when they first started showing up, you know, it was old Jiro and old Ichiryu and Acacia in his older days. But then once Midora shows up, you know, his ghost starts to cry, and he starts to age backwards to when he was in his youth. And then he goes up to the table when all the different members are in their youth, when they were actually together and were a family.
Oh,
and, that's where the chapter ends.
And Setsuna is also seeing this, too. Like, she's seeing that this is happening, so she's setting a little... it's fucking... Oh, it's awesome.
And, that's the chapter. There's one more chapter of Toriko, but honestly, if this had been the finale, oh my god. This is such a perfect chapter. I don't have anything bad to say about it, I don't think.
This is what the final chapter of Toriko should have been perfectly. It covered everything. Like, the whole theme of Toriko is about making this good food and sharing it with others. And this is a 10-year almost long series having that moment for the entire series of sharing it and remembering all the good times we had with the series, all the side characters we grew to like, all these interesting moments of remembering, like the puffer fish and all these like small little details, and Komatsu remembering how his relationship with Toriko has grown over the course of not only this adventure, but even over the course of this menu that he's cooking. He's crying. It all closes with this final story, this family that was torn apart that kind of became like the main crux and final like conflict within this entire story with Acacia and everything like that. Ends with them getting to share one last meal together as Toriko's kind of smiling. It's beautiful beyond words. Like, as you said, like, if this is the penultimate chapter, if the last chapter was Toriko farting on the page for 16 straight pages, I would still say this is probably...
They've got to remake that shit clap.
Like, even if it did it, I would still say this is the best ending to a manga of, like, any of the Jump ones that I've read. Because this is everything I want. Like, when One Piece ends, I hope it's as good as this. I pray that it gets it as perfect as this. Because this is exactly what you wanted with Toriko. It's funny, it's goofy, it's emotional, it's silly, but it reminds you of everything you've enjoyed throughout this series. And I know a lot of people are kind of used to us talking more negatively about Toriko, or at least in, like, a less enthused manner, because, you know, a long time, you know, for the past few years, we've generally been either, like, kind of blasé on the series or kind of up and down on it. But the thing to remember is that for a while, we loved Toriko. I mean, it was my series of the year, I think, in like 2013 or something like that. And this is
too long ago, yeah.
Yeah, and this is the chapter that reminded me of why it was. Because I'm like, all these moments, all these emotions, these are all so real and so vivid and so perfectly kind of put back into my memory. I just love how everyone got a little focus on this. Like, this is better than Naruto's final chapter in my mind. I just think that it hits everything I would have I loved about this series. Everyone's getting around and having a big fucking party and hanging out. Like, this is the thing that Bleach's final chapter didn't have, where it was like, oh, Chad's off doing a boxing fan.
They got too busy
to come out of work.
They got together and, you know, nothing.
Yeah, like, this, it's like, oh, they're having a big party.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's... The great thing about it is that it perfectly embodies what the spirit of the series was about, what the main character was all about, which was eating together with people at the same table. Mm-hmm. It brings closure to the villains of the story. And it reflects on the series as a whole. So you can look back and see like, oh, there were all these wonderful moments that we had together. It feels so complete mm-hmm. as this concluding chapter in the story. There is one more chapter that we're going to get next week, and you know, who knows what's going to happen with that. But yeah, if the past couple of years of Toriko had been anywhere near close to this quality on a regular basis, then we would have Toriko would still be, I think, one of our favorite series all the time. And we'd probably think much more positively about its conclusion if it all matched this quality of chapter.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love this chapter. I think the next chapter hopefully gives a little bit more closure to Toriko and the Four Kings, because they don't really get much focus on this. There's like a few casual mentions to them of like, oh, hey, that item's on my full course menu. I'm hoping there's a little bit more, since that was kind of built up as like the real relationship within it, like that's the Straw Hats of this story, more or less, and then, you know, obviously him and Komatsu. That's my hope for the final chapter. But in my mind, this is the best chapter of the week. I know we're not doing the weekly.
It's going to be a sequel series.
Yeah, boring.
Boring.
Oh my god. But in my mind, the really, like, no chapter comes close to this. This isn't just one of my favorite chapters of Toriko. This isn't just my favorite chapter of the week. This is one of my favorite chapters, I think, of any series I can remember in a while. This is just, this hits every spot perfectly for me. Like, a good conclusion is what makes or breaks something for me, and usually most series kind of stumble at the end. It's hard to like, tie everything together perfectly, but this did it in so many ways. This was just great.
Well, with that said, let's wrap up. I think that I guess it's safe to assume that our favorite chapter this week, both of us.
Yeah, I think Toriko gets it for both of us.
Tied with Promised Neverland in our listener in the chat room's poll.
No, it's not anymore. Someone just randomly voted for Toriko. I don't know who that was.
Oh, I guess it's Toriko. Oh, well.
I guess it has to be Toriko.
Could that possibly be?
No, I can understand people liking the Promised Neverland chapter as well.
So, weekly MVPs, I guess I'm going to give it to Twice, because it was definitely something unexpected for his character in particular this week. I'm not sure exactly if I'm going to like what we get out of the character going forward, if I'm going to prefer it to when he was just wacky and contradicted himself, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's Twice for me as well. I'm glad you told me his name, otherwise I'd have been like, Double Dude!
Double Dude!
Double Man!
Double Man! So, with that said, that was a very short favorite section. So thank you guys for joining us for Weekly Manga Recap. We tend to record the show Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, although sometimes we do need to change things up. For example, we do stuff normally on hitbox.tv/reloadc, but just in case there's a difference, we need to use a different streaming site. Then follow us on Twitter so you can stay updated and you can know exactly when and where we're going to start the show. Follow us at RLOT, at Y Ruler of Time, the podcast at WMR Podcast. Yeah. If you want to help support the show, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, we also sometimes, you know, just follow the WMR Twitter, because sometimes we'll just come on there to make comments on this week's chapters or talk about things. Actually, I'm getting prepared because we mentioned way at the start of this year that we were going to expand upon our best ofs of the year. And I'm currently putting together the list. I've been taking notes as we've been going through the year, but there are a lot of places where I still have holes that I kind of want to flesh out. So I've been calling for people to like give us some of their suggestions. So I'll throw one out here on the show. And if you want to just let us know, one of our categories is the best speech. So of the series we discussed this year or the chapters, what were your favorite speeches in a chapter? So like, it can be ones that are epic, ones that are silly, you know, whatever it is. Like I, one of the ones we have on there is Midora going over his full course menu about fucking like ferocious tears were my drink and all that shit.
The Oedipus complex menu. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyone that are on there, if you want to send those to us, send us what's your recommendation, what you think are some of the best ones of this year. And if you're able to, it's a huge help. If you can, give us the chapter title or number as well. That way I can like kind of pull it out when we're doing it. But we're going to try to make this year's year-end episode like really kind of cool with special awards and then make it a real big deal. So send us your recommendations because we're building up a really cool list and I've gotten some great recommendations from people already.
Also, be sure to check out our past episodes on our YouTube channel, on iTunes, and on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. Be sure to subscribe to us on those platforms, especially on iTunes, where you can also leave a commentary to help us beat the woodworking podcasts. And if you want to help out the show, of course, you know, share it. Share it with someone who you think will like it, if they're into manga, or if they're into two dorks talking to each other and occasionally mentioning manga, while honestly just talking about literally everything else instead of getting to the fucking point.
I'm like, Nick, they started selling beer at my grocery store. It's so great. Anyway, what's the deal with the fucking Toriko? Is he a man or what? Oh, I didn't think there was still beer in that. Oh.
Oh. I wonder how old that bottle is now. Oh, God.
It's only like a day old, but I really didn't think there's anything left in that. Prop humor, guys. Sure. I sacrificed myself for you.
If you want to send us feedback, ask us questions, or suggest manga for us to read, you can send that stuff via email to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Special thanks also go out to our Patreon supporters. If you want to give us a little bit of extra help, you can become a supporter, and we'll thank you personally on the show, and you get to enjoy all sorts of bonus stuff, including the extra episode that we do month to month. Like this month, we're going to be doing Super Ultra Deluxe Weekly Manga Recap Lives.
Yes, we're going to be doing an all-star version. So actually, that's another thing. Follow the Twitter, because I'm going to start posting out there. Guys, give us recommendations for a One Piece chapter you want us to voice act. Essentially, the gloves are off when it comes to this. You guys just tell us what chapters, doesn't have to be with anything recent, what chapter of this series you'd love to see us do a weekly manga recap lives on, and we'll put it in there. So any of the series we've done doesn't even have to be the ones we're currently doing. You know, if you want a Naruto chapter, a Bleach chapter, a Bakuman chapter, fucking whatever, just... You know, we'll show us the suggestions. We'll pick some and we'll have like four, you know, whatever, and we'll do those. But I also want to give a special thanks to our newest patrons, Main Entrance, Wolf Kaiser, and Brett McMullen. So thank you to all you guys. Boosh is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much for the support and help.
And of course, also thanks to the guys who help us put the podcast together, including Steve Manor, Tower Crash, and Darren. And including a number of NSFW works on his Twitter, on his Tumblr, on Patreon, on his DeviantArt. He's everywhere. He puts it out all over the place.
I think Donald Trump actually made him chief of security, so we're going to start seeing him in the news, too. He's just he's ubiquitous. He's every fucking where.
And, of course, the infamous Plant, who helps us out in a number of different ways, including making the frame you guys see around us whenever we stream and whenever we put the episode on YouTube.
Yes, also, he's been, this is a sort of off-topic thing here, but I've been playing a lot of WoW with him recently, and a couple other people.
Poor guys.
Yeah, we're having fun. We're trying to, like, work together. Like, we actually have a guild. It's the Apocalypse Dragons, made after, you know, the joke from WMR. So if you're interested in playing with us, you could be someone brand new starring or whatever. We're on Khadgar US, and we're on the Horde side. If you want to hit up the guild or anything like that, just send a message over to me. My main is Dr. Ravioli, just Dr. Ravioli, essentially. So if you want to join in, and we you know, jump into Discord with us and have fun, just let us know, and it'll be pretty cool.
All right. That's going to do it, though. Thank you guys for joining us here on Weekly Manga Recap. We will see you guys next week, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's more or less it. I had something I thought I wanted to end the show with, but I guess in lieu of that, did you watch Dave Chappelle on the Saturday Night Live?
No, I did not.
Oh.
Nope.
You gotta check out his monologue. It's glorious.
I've seen the really emotional, serious part of the monologue.
Okay.
But I haven't seen the rest of it.
All right. Well, that's fair enough, then.
Looking at all those black people and Bradley.
Yeah, I love the way he throws it out. Looking at all these black people and Bradley. There's nothing but black people. I don't know, Bradley Cooper was in there somehow. Oh, man. We'll be doing JoJo next week. Mostly, yeah. Right? So, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure next week. It's weird. Toriko's ending the same week as Thanksgiving, which is very appropriate when you think about
That's
it.
That's great, yeah.
And then we'll be doing JoJo at the same time. Uh-huh. One Piece is coming back, and we have jump starts. So while this might be one of the shortest episodes of Weekly Manga Recap in recent memory, next week might be one of the fucking longest outside of Air Gear, so...
We might have to start a little earlier, I think.
Well, here's the thing, Nick. This is how we market it. Get prepared. Prepare yourself to get stuffed on Thanksgiving a little bit earlier by getting stuffed with audio in your ear when Weekly Manga Recap, the double stuffing edition.
This is very sexual sounding.
Oh, we're in your ear hole making noises that make you happy. And one part of us is edible. Hi, everybody.